This is Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition. Subscribe now to receive our quarterly print journal, one of the most significant platforms in the intellectual and spiritual life of our religious community since the journal's founding in 1958. Our most recent issue, just released, contains many special offerings exploring the thought and teachings of Rev. Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal, timed with his 10th Yahrzeit observed this week. But as listeners to our podcast know, aside from the print journal, traditiononline.org delivers ongoing digital content a number of times a week, including a very significant recent series on the long impact of COVID, now 5 years after the arrival of the pandemic. In this episode of our podcast, the guest editor of that series, Rabbi Yehuda Halpert, conducts a reflective and multi-perspective conversation on the changes that have occurred in the past half decade in our religious and communal institutions, communal trust, synagogue dynamics, as well as the emotional and spiritual struggles experienced by individuals throughout the pandemic. He talks with the 6th authors in the series, all of whom draw on their experiences as mental health professionals, educators, administrators, rabbis, spiritual leaders, to look back on the spring of 2020 and to consider where we're holding now. Visit traditiononline.org to read all the entries in this series. I'll take a moment to thank Rabbi Halpert for initiating this project and give a shout out to his new book, Speaking to an Empty Shul, Timeless Lessons from Unprecedented Times. It's a kind of rabbinic diary that describes his time leading Congregation Ahavat Shalom in Teaneck throughout the pandemic years. In the first part of this episode, Yehuda speaks with Gila Muskin, executive director and co-founder of Yesh Tikva, an organization dedicated to working with couples navigating the challenges of infertility, and with Dr. Carl Hochhauser, a pediatric psychologist who's also on the counseling and teaching staff at Yeshivat HaKotel. Together, they focus on the emotional and spiritual struggles experienced by individuals during the pandemic.
I'd like to take the opportunity to discuss with Gila Block and Carl Hochhauser their perspectives on how COVID and the pandemic, and especially the lockdown, impacted the individuals and the people that they had the experience to interact with. So turning the stage first to Gila, in your essay, you mentioned that infertility is often a silent struggle. How does this silence impact the spiritual identity of those experiencing it? And in your perspective, what religious language or framework might help those people who are experiencing that feel more seen, validated, or spiritually included going forward in the post-pandemic world?
Thank you, Rabbi Halpert. It's a wonderful question. And I think that the biggest piece is that beautifully, so much of our tradition and our ritual experience revolves around children and ritual experiences of bringing children into our next generation of education, of understanding Judaism. And we're just getting off of Pesach, which is our most ritually experienced Jewish child-centered of all rituals of Vehigadat HaLebenchan. You're going to teach and pass on Judaism to this next generation. And what happens to that individual who's sitting at that Seder and doesn't yet have a child? And I think that the piece that we can focus on in how we shift spirituality is a catchphrase that we use a lot at Yesh Tikva in regards to how we speak about infertility, of the yes and. Yes, so much of Judaism and our experiences revolve around a beautiful passing down of our Jewish identity and Jewish experience to the next generation. But if we can find language, both for those who are experiencing infertility and for the community at large, of how we can be more inclusive, yes, we're talking about children. And it's so important that all of us speak about this. All of us speak about Judaism and passing it down to ourselves and engaging with it and the essence of it. And if we could find and tap into that essence, then we're able to continue to be a part of the spiritual experience of Judaism.
So would you say that those individuals who are struggling with infertility, when they're trying to have their voices heard, is the silence of their struggle that they don't have the opportunity to speak and Vehigadat HaLebenchan, literally to speak to that next generation, and that's the silence of their struggle? Or the silence of their struggle is that when they're walking by people in the street or when they're sitting next to them in shul, the person sitting next to them does not realize that they're struggling at all? Is it the silence vis-a-vis their friends and family and co-congregants, or is the fact that they are themselves silenced?
I think it's a mixture of both. I, from my experience and from my speaking with others who have experienced infertility through work, it really is both a silence of shame of if Judaism is so ritualistically based on having children, what is so wrong with me that I can't even be a part of such an integral piece of Judaism? Therefore, I'm silenced in the sense of shame and can't and won't and have a hard time finding that space. But I think also it comes from the rhetoric. The rhetoric is so child focused. And so it in and of itself silences those who are experiencing it.
So Carl, I imagine in your experience as a mental health professional, you deal with individuals who are struggling with a range of issues. Sometimes sometimes maybe they're not able or don't feel comfortable sharing those experiences or really opening themselves even up, opening themselves up to those experiences. How have you come across this issue of people struggling in silence? And what would you say that our community could do a better job of helping those people who are struggling in silence?
Well, I think take it back to the issue of the pandemic for a second. I think one of the things that I experienced was people saying that who had been struggling with different things in the past. I work a lot with individuals with cancer. And so that's something that they had struggled with before, all of a sudden now everyone else is getting a taste of it, meaning the fragility of health and this idea that people take, McGill spoke to you, for example, about fertility. We tend to take for granted everyone just assumes, oh, I'll get married then. And all I remember speaking to people like deciding, oh, I think I'll have four kids, or I think I'll have the kids at this in these intervals, and don't realize that it's not as a given as one might think it would be. Same way I think that health or even mental health is not as a given as we might think it would be. And what COVID, I think, tried to show the world is that it showed, but we all saw it during the pandemic, is that things that we all took for granted, like health, community, these things were not as simple as we might have thought they would be. And hopefully we could come to appreciate them now, afterwards. And even the concept of a silent struggle, which is something that I'm suffering alone because no one else knows what I'm going through. But when other people are going through similar things also, that could sometimes take the loneliness out of the experience that I'm having.
So that's actually a great segue to one of the points that you raised in your essay, which is there obviously were a lot of negatives that came from COVID, but perhaps one positive, perhaps a silver lining, was the fact that our community became more attuned and more aware of the significance of mental health issues, how important they are and how prevalent they are across the spectrum of our community. You noted that the stigma that goes along with mental health was dissipated a little because it became more prevalent. Are you noticing that kind of realization that the stigma of mental health should be addressed, or that there should be a destigmatization associated with mental health? Is that something which has really permeated throughout our community and we've built on post-COVID, or now that we're 5 years out and you interact with folks who are dealing with mental health issues, they still feel the exact same stigmas? Did some communities deal with it better than others?
I want to differentiate here between, I think, Israel and the rest of the world, because I think it's a little different in the Jewish communities. I think for the best of my knowledge, I think we've gotten a lot better at people understanding that many struggle with mental illness, and it's more acceptable, to the best of my knowledge, to talk, go see a psychologist, to even talk about the fact that I see a psychologist. Yeshivas, seminaries, schools all have either someone in-house, or they have their people in the community that they refer out to. That's much more common. And even sectors of the Jewish community that perhaps beforehand, the more yeshivish parts of the community, I think, that weren't as overt and about these kinds of things beforehand, they all do it also now. I think what I differentiate between sometimes is the fact that I'm referring in my community, I'm referring people to mental health professionals, versus the fact that I'm talking about it. Okay, it's much more common, I think, to go to psychologists now. I think the idea of talking about it is a little bit less common. That having been said, even take this is not exactly an academic publication, but I think we look at something like Mishpacha magazine, right, which is a bit of bellwether sometimes for things that go on. There's a lot of content there about these things, about this therapist and that therapist, whatever it may be. And I think it's become somewhat normalized. I it could be coincidence. It probably isn't. I think I've seen a big change over the past 5 years since the pandemic. In Israel, it's a little more complicated because I think that the last year and a half in Israel, there's been on top of that, a greater awareness of the concept of PTSD and trauma and things like because of the war that we've gone through here and are still in the middle of. And that is, you know, was built on what happened in COVID. So I think here in Israel, it's become even more normalized to do it, to talk to a psychologist, to get referrals, and again, to be very, very open about it. And that's something I think that is shifting, and I hope will continue to shift. The idea of not just that I go, but the fact that I'm the same way that I might talk about the fact that I might go to the podiatrist or the dentist, I might also just say, yeah, I've got an appointment on Thursday with a psychologist.
So Gila, would you say that that distinction holds true in the fertility context as well? I get the impression that individuals, couples, and families who are struggling with infertility, there's no doubt that they are seeking resources and that people are aware that there are resources out there and that there is a conversation about which doctors to go to and there are sites and websites and your organization itself provide people information. But there still seems to be a significant distinction between people seeking treatment and people being willing to discuss and speak out publicly about seeking treatment. I guess the first question is, does that distinction exist? Are people talking about it? And has there been a change in that, if any, from COVID to today, 5 years later?
Definitely. And I think that the way I would frame it even is that there's a difference between, we speak about this in how people share their fertility story. And I'm wondering if this might be similar to how people talk about other mental health challenges that they may be experiencing. There's a difference between secrecy and privacy. I think that we've moved a lot beyond secrecy. I don't need to necessarily be secret about the reality that I am struggling with the mental health components of infertility. That also doesn't mean I'm necessarily going to tell you that tomorrow I'm seeing a therapist, because that's private. And so, yes, we've seen a tremendous shift in the ability to speak more openly, big picture, while still seeing individuals being more private about the details of those experiences. And I'm wondering if that might be along the how we speak about in mental health in general. And I know, like in Mishpacha, I'm not usually a reader, but I happened to pick up an issue over Pesach. And there were multiple articles written by mental health professionals answering questions of anonymous writers about their mental health struggles. So I think there's definitely that we are not secret about it, but we're still private. I'm not necessarily signing my name at the end.
Interesting. Actually, add one thing, just jump in for a second. I think that when I speak to sometimes families who are going through both physical health struggles and mental health struggles, they sometimes talk about the fact that the you know, open up by talking about the silent suffering or things like that. I think sometimes the idea that a mental health struggle, nobody sees it. Kind of, if I work with my cancer patients, so it's very often very evident to everyone around them what they have, you know, that's a pro and a con. But something like mental health struggles and even infertility in a lot of cases, no one knows that the individual is coping with this, and that sometimes is a big negative. And they find sometimes that they get less empathy sometimes from the community.
Yeah, it's an intangible loss, because it's the loss of potential with infertility as opposed to the loss of a tangible item that one or person that one lost.
That's a very insightful distinction between kind of, you don't have to be wearing your problems or your issues on your sleeve for there to be an automatic recognition by the community, or by your friends, by your family, of the fact that you're struggling with something, while there could be someone else who's standing right next to you who's struggling with issues which are just as significant, just as debilitating, just as important, but no one's aware of them at all, and how that plays out. I'd like to pivot for a moment from the conversation in terms of just acknowledging mental health and the existence of these issues and how perhaps the community's reaction shifted from the community to the individual. Carl, in your essay, you pointed out a fascinating idea that as individuals were dealing and struggling with the difficulties of the pandemic, there's a lot of research that demonstrated that those who had a strong religious connection, those who felt connected to God or spirituality, coped with and dealt with that on a much higher level. So much so that people who struggled actually maybe came out in a quote unquote in a better place, if that's possible to quantify in some way, shape, or form. And I guess the question for you is, how do you really demonstrate or quantify or produce a study. Can we really say that with any accuracy? What does it mean that people were more religiously connected and therefore they did better during the pandemic? How are we defining religious? How are we defining connected? Was it people learning Daf Yomi who did better than people who weren't learning Daf Yomi? Was it people who davened every day? Is it possible to address that multifaceted question?
Yeah, I mean, look, the research part of it's really complicated. And one of the things I tried to point out is I think that the research is really not yet done, or at least not yet published. Because again, we could differentiate even between religiosity and observance. Okay, so religiosity might mean connecting to spirituality, to God, and things like that from a more philosophical sense, belief. And then there's observance, which is, like you said, something like Daf Yomi, going to Minyan, tefillin, whatever. Both of those might be helpful separately. Okay, they don't always go together. I think there's a greater understanding, even in the academic world, that this is a coping tool. I was just speaking to a patient yesterday coping with significant health issues and explaining that you know, even if I'm drinking the religious Kool-Aid, as it were, okay, but even if I wasn't, if we're taking my kippah off for a second, I can say that the religion is a tool, so much so, for example, that the National Cancer Institute in America, part of the NIH, says if you want to be a national cancer center, you have to have chaplains on staff. Okay, something that I don't think they would have said 60, 70 years ago. I think this is an understanding that religiosity, spirituality, observance is a coping mechanism. And anyone who has a connection to the spiritual world, again, for us, it's observant Judaism, which is great. Okay, and that's what I believe. But even if it's someone else has something else, they can use that as a way to cope with it. The patient with yesterday had to deal with the issue of uncertainty. Okay, one of the hardest things in life is to cope with uncertainty. And being able to understand, control what I can control, then figuring out how to cope with all the stuff that's left over that I can't control. And one of the main ways people do that is the understanding that there's they say a higher power. And I believe I'm going to Kaddish Baruch Hu, that God essentially controls other things that I can control. And I can sometimes say, I do what I can with what I can. And then I know that I can rely on Hashem to who runs the world to control everything else. That doesn't mean, you know, the Chazon Ish, that doesn't mean necessarily it's going to work out in the way that I would consider being good, but at least I know it's not random, that it's not just being left to blow in the wind.
So Gila, in your interactions with patients and folks that are coming to Yesh Tikvah for help, is this a parallel experience that you've seen as well? Have you seen individuals who have a religious or a spiritual connection, or as Carl pointed out, the difference between observance and spirituality, but do you see those individuals, A, cope differently with infertility struggles? And I guess from your perspective, are they slightly more successful or able to go through the process in a more, I wouldn't say easy because it's not an easy process, but somehow they're able to ease the process because of their spirituality and their connection?
So I don't know that I can completely answer that, but just, I guess, from thinking about it a little bit in terms of personal experience and that of individuals who have shared with us, I think the understanding, firstly, of hope, to hold on to hope through any struggle is coming through adversity that builds hope. Hope isn't something that's born out of nothing. It's born out of the experience of adversity. So if you are able to hold on to hope, it's because you have gone through an adversity and you have a higher being that is now carrying you through it. So there's definitely that ability that even when I can't hold hope, that either others or God is holding that hope for me so that it gives me the ability to push through some of the most difficult times in my life. And I definitely, we see that individuals who are spiritually inclined and connect to that, and obviously I can't speak to whether they're actively participating in religious activities on a daily basis, but rather more of a connectivity to God as the being that is holding them through their struggles, there's definitely that ability to persevere longer through the experience of fertility treatments.
So, Carl, you actually made another point in your essay, just building off of what Gila just said, of the ability to persevere longer, that it seems that people who have struggled sometimes are able to come out even further ahead, and that somebody who didn't struggle during COVID entered COVID at one level and left COVID pretty much the same place because they didn't struggle. While someone who had a struggle, whether it was a mental health struggle, whether it was a financial struggle, whether it was a family struggle, if by going through that struggle and going through that process, it actually strengthened them and made them more adept to be able to handle future challenges. Do you think, first of all, have I stated your thesis correctly? Is that actually an accurate statement?
Yep, I think so.
And then if that is the case, it's a little bit like the idea of b'makom she'ba'alei tshuva omdin tzaddikim gemurim einan yicholim la'amod. Should we be seeking out struggle so that we can raise and increase our level? Or really, you know, it's okay not to struggle and it's okay to be where you are? Or is the human experience such that we're always struggling and it's just a question of how apparent it is?
I'm going to hedge on that one, I think, because I think that we definitely shouldn't be seeking out struggles, but I do think that it's important if we always avoid areas of discomfort, which I see a lot, particularly in the youth today, like in adolescents, who run away from any kind of discomfort. If I continually run away from discomfort, then I never make myself uncomfortable and I never build my muscles to be able to get stronger, because that's how it is. If I'm in the gym and I never actually break a sweat or it's never hard, then I'm going to actually never advance in what I'm trying to do to get stronger. That doesn't mean that I want to jump in seek out trauma so that I could have post-traumatic growth. That's a different story. It is true that the patients that I see, whether it's has to do with COVID or anything else, those who went through difficult times, they not all of them, but a significant portion of them, you know, have some kind of post-traumatic growth. And I've had a lot of people tell me that they wouldn't have it any other way. You ask people like, who went through something difficult, eventually you would Gilles say the same thing, but, you know, said like, I've said, okay, well, you wish it doesn't come up like this, but they'll say, you know, would you, if you could do it all over again, would you wish that you never got sick? And they would say, absolutely not. I'm glad that this happened to me. I would never have traded for the world. I met amazing people and I learned so much about myself and the world and I got so much stronger. And if I live my life again, I would the same thing would happen. Sometimes I point out to them that like, I wish the world could work out that you could have those same gains, but have gotten it a different way. But that's not the way not the way it goes.
So I would love to keep having these conversations for hours more, but time is short. Gila, I'm going to leave you with, going to give you the opportunity to get the last word in. And I'm going to ask you that question, building off of what Carl just said. Many people, I'd say the vast majority of people, are very uncomfortable talking about issues of infertility. And not only those who are struggling with it, but especially people in the community who are not struggling with it, but know that others are struggling. Do you feel that anything positive came out of the pandemic vis-a-vis our ability to deal with discomfort and thus the greater community's ability to be a resource and to interact with people who are struggling with infertility and get past that discomfort?
Yes and no. I think more no than yes. I think that based off of the last part that Carl had just shared, Dr. Hochhauser had said that it was those who came through adversity during COVID who walked out changed, and those who didn't experience that adversity really went in and came out in a similar space. And I think that because they didn't necessarily experience, and this is my speculation, obviously, no research to back this, but I think that because individuals may not have experienced any adversity through COVID, it couldn't have had that positive impact to say, I understand adversity, now I can hold space for others who've experienced adversity, whether it's the same or different than mine. And there are so many parallels between the adversity experienced through COVID and that of an individual facing infertility in terms of the isolation that is created, and the uncertainty and the waiting. And I'm sure that it parallels to so many experiences of those in struggle. But there's definitely was so much conversation within the fertility community of how the microcosm of infertility was felt as a macro experience of the world. And yet individuals who really didn't struggle deeply through COVID, but were rather, it was a nuisance of an experience, I think didn't walk away saying, aha, I get it. Now I can hold space for others who experience a similar struggle, but rather, okay, let's move on. Life continues. And we kind of ended back where we started.
Okay. Gila Block, Executive Director of Yesh Tikva, Dr. Carl Hochhauser, thank you so much for your time, for your insights.
Our conversation now transitions from the individual to the communal, focusing on our schools, synagogues, and the broader Jewish community. Our moderator, Yehuda Halpert, is now joined by Rabbis Josh Kahn, Rosh Yeshiva of the Torah Academy of Bergen County, Daniel Karapkin, Rabbi of the Bayit in Toronto, Lenny Matenki, Rabbi of Congregation Kins of West Rogers Park, and also Dean of the Ida Crown Jewish Academy, and Larry Rothwax, Rabbi at Teaneck Beth Aaron. As the conversation continues, the participants revisit aspects of the COVID pandemic and its post-pandemic consequences, all the while challenging and sharpening each other's formulations and conclusions.
Larry Matenki, you had a unique perspective on the impact of COVID on several different constituents, but in particular, with respect to the impact on your students, you lamented in your essay that you had observed a decrease in student resilience and a hesitancy for students to take on new challenges. Have any strategies been especially effective in rebuilding student confidence? And are there any examples of programs or moments where you've seen resilience rekindled and you've seen your students come back to their old selves?
There's a lot of research out there about what creates resilience in students. But among the most powerful is the question of social emotional skills and also relationships. And that's what we've chosen to focus on in the school by expanding a program of machanchim, which I guess in the yeshivish world would be called mashkichim, that all of the grades now have educators, both rebbes and also morot, who are responsible for the grades, who work with them and have time with them. And even now a program which we began this year for the freshmen of a homeroom program that's focused on developing social emotional skills and meets weekly with all of the freshmen with a group of teachers who have been trained in providing that. So we're focusing a lot on that social emotional piece. In terms of the relationships, we do find that the students have meaningful relationships with teachers, but it's ways that we're trying to find new ways to create. So it's as simple as not looking at the simple Shabbaton or things like that, but trying to find more points of interaction outside the classroom for teachers, and we're continuing to experiment with that.
Interesting. Thank you. All right, Khan. From your perspective, have you seen moments of resilience, or do you have similar programs that you're engaging in at TABC?
Yes, so what Rory Matenki explained resonates very much with my experience in terms of the lack of resilience and the need to support more resiliency. And still, I would argue there's a counterpoint as well. Resilience is a muscle. And the COVID experience, I think, serves both as a historical marker, right? Oftentimes we think about kind of pre-COVID, post-COVID. It serves as that historical marker, but it's also a reservoir that I find we turn back to at times. And in many ways, having exercised that muscle, which we did throughout COVID, of incredible resiliency, provides us with awareness and a roadmap to do so again. And I'll give a few examples, kind of with a range. One is a sample size of my family, so take that for what it's worth. Over Chol HaMoed, you know, we have the challenge of what do we do today? And so, you know, one night we were sitting down and trying to plan out the next day Chol HaMoed activity. Think about what's going to resonate with the range of ages and kids. And one of my kids suggested, why don't we do the family color war like we did during COVID? And that resonated with me in terms of that notion of, you know, boredom, not sure what to do, but that muscle of resiliency of, oh, actually, we can make something fun with a little bit of creativity. And I was really impressed by that. They weren't prompted by us. But that was, again, just an example of seeing that resiliency muscle, recalling something that happened during COVID. Another example, larger scale at TABC, Torah Academy, Bergen County, we're in the middle of a significant construction project. And at the end of December, beginning of January, we had to restructure some of the spaces, some of the learning spaces we were using. We had to take a few classrooms offline. And we were able to go back to kind of that roadmap of how do we learn in less than ideal situations. And we went back to the lunchroom and the other room. And there was certainly some PTSD, I think, people experienced. But at the same time, we did draw back on that reservoir of resilience and say, okay, one second, we could figure out how to make it work, again, in less than ideal learning environments. And I'll give one more example, but something that's very much on my mind is the smartphone revolution right now, figuring out how to address you know, smartphones in schools, and many schools are grappling, either have or will go phone free. And thinking about significant change like that and how are our students going to handle it? Again, I do find going back to that notion of we were able to handle more extreme situations in COVID. And so that notion of resiliency, I think, is a muscle. At times it may be atrophying, but at times, again, we're able to really exercise it like we did years ago. I think, like Rabbi Matenki said, the bedrock of that are the relationships that COVID really highlighted, is the need to invest in strengthening those relationships. And that served as a foundation and a bedrock in order to be able to draw back on the reservoir of resiliency.
So this idea of kind of building that muscle and building resiliency, so I kind of, it sounds like you're agreeing with Rabbi Matenki's basic premise that there was a deficit in resiliency which COVID created. Rabbi Karapkin, from a different perspective, from the perspective of the pulpit, from the perspective of your interactions in the shul and outside the shul, do you agree with that premise that COVID impacted people's resiliency and ability to react? If yes, what have you seen in the shul to address that? Or if you disagree, are there examples where you've actually, you know, did not witness that, did not focus on that?
Well, I think we'd have to more carefully define what we mean by resiliency when we're dealing with adults. I think I understand the idea better when we're dealing with children who were introduced to a completely different learning environment. I think with adults, there was less of a test of their resiliency. If people, instead of going to a live shear, were invited to come to a Zoom shear, or if people had to stay home from shul for a certain number of weeks, I think that people adapted fairly well, especially many of our congregants who were very, very happy to spend more time with their family. I think that people were able to adapt and to adjust religiously. Whether they were able to adjust in other areas of their lives is something that I really can't say for sure, other than just recalling some difficult situations with individuals who were shut-ins and didn't have the support system that many other families had. So I'm not really sure that I can address the resiliency issue with the same level of observation that people who are heads of school can.
Okay, let's appreciate that perspective and appreciate kind of the reverse perspective from maybe different demographics at different ages. Rabbi Rothwax, from your perspective at Beth Aaron, your perspective in terms of interacting across a very broad age demographic, both in terms of the youth, in terms of the teens in your shul, but also interacting with the adults, with the members. Did you notice this kind of breakdown in people's willingness to take risks and to kind of move forward and plan post-COVID? Or did you feel that it was kind of more of a status quo? Those people who traditionally had always, you know, had reservations about resiliency, maybe it manifested greater, but others were really just able to bounce back on that.
So I, like Rabbi Karapkin, I can't say that I've seen any significant decline in resiliency, at least the way we seem to be describing it at the moment. I think that what people have had to deal with over the past 5 years, even post-COVID, at least in my experiences, just seems unprecedented. And people are facing stressors and circumstances that, you know, perhaps they've never had to confront before. To suggest that people were, you know, naturally resilient and resourceful and just sort of had the natural internal resources to deal with all of this, you know, prior to 2020, and now they have somehow become impaired in some way. I'm just not convinced. I think that the world in so many ways has changed so dramatically. I think that, you know, part of it is due to COVID, but I'm not even sure that much of it is. I think that there were trends that were already in motion. I think that so many things about our world has changed so dramatically over the course of the last generation. And we're still trying to figure out whether or not we know exactly how to manage all of this. So yeah, it may appear at times and may express itself. And we may interpret these, you know, these changes as if people are quote unquote less resilient. But I think, you know, because of the fact that we've changed so much and so much has changed, we may just need to think about completely, different, using different methods, different tools. Programming in schools is one example that we heard, just about how we, you know, how we nurture our natural capacity to be able to thrive in all situations. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm not convinced that we are any less resilient than we once were, but I think that the world is so different in so many ways, and we really need to think about, you know, how we are managing that individually and on a communal level.
Rabbi Matanki, so the last two responses kind of differed with your perspective. We want to hit on a bunch of topics. I'm going to give you literally, you're on the clock. I'm going to give you 1 minute after hearing Rabbi Rothbach's perspective and Rabbi Karapkin's perspective. Is, you know, do you have a response to that? Do you see things differently?
No, I don't.
1 minute, you're on the clock.
I don't see it that much differently. I think the difference which we have, which Rabbi Kahn and I noticed, is we're dealing with children who didn't have the opportunity to develop those skills of resiliency versus adults who may have had a traumatic event, but may have already developed those skills of resiliency. So we see it more maybe in the school, in school-aged children, than you would in the adult population.
Okay, that's a great point, just in terms of, again, focusing on the different demographics and seeing that in the kids specifically. All right, so let's shift slightly. We're still going to stay within the school framework. But Rabbi Kahn, in your essay, you describe how COVID really forced schools to reassess priorities and values in real time, and really kind of in a moment of almost necessity or desperation, you had choices to make and you had to prioritize. Can you recall a specific moment when there were two deeply held values which clashed, how the resolution shaped the school's policy during COVID and going forward? And then I guess as a follow-up, post-pandemic, do you feel that schools are continuing to struggle with these higher level thinking in terms of priorities and what's most significant, or it kind of has inertia just taken us back to the old syllabi and the old routines and the old perspectives? You know, what did you see in terms of boots on the ground during the school year?
So I think we all have mission statements. Many of our mission statements look fairly similar, and sometimes we display them in different places, but I found often that they were displayed and not always implemented in action in a very precise way. The concept of competing values is certainly not new to COVID, right? We can go back to the Torah already and think about, to me, certainly Parshas Vayera is rich in terms of conflicting values. It opens with Avram having to decide, conversation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hachnasas Orchem, how do I resolve that conflict? It goes on in terms of Sarah wanting Avram to send out Yishmael. What do? I have my wife telling me something. I have this son who's a bad influence on my other son. And on the other hand, I'm this loving father. And how do I navigate that conflict? And the reality is a conflict usually comes because of limited resources or things being mutually exclusive. What happened during COVID is there's always a healthy clash between classroom learning and student activities or athletics, right? By its very nature, student activities, programming, expansion of athletics that involve going to tournaments, take away from classroom learning time. And so there's a range of feelings that teachers have. There are some teachers who subscribe fully to the value of programming, and there are other teachers who feel like schools should be schools and camps should be camps. And why is color war happening during school? Why is a team missing school time for a basketball tournament? Various things. But typically, schools, we have a rhythm for our annual calendar, right? And teachers understand we did it last year, likely we'll do it again next year. And so they tend to accept that. What happened with COVID was it really forced us to make active decisions because the calendar wasn't going to just replicate what it was last year. And so I can't point to a particular moment per se as much as the planning process of deciding what the upcoming year was going to be as we were, you know, a phased reopening of schools. And the question was, were we going to run trips? Were we going to run athletic programming? And early on, we made a decision, which again, was a decision of priorities, a decision of conflicting priorities. Were we going to maximize classroom learning time at the exclusion of trips? Or were we going to run trips and athletic programs? And we decided that COVID was not only posing a physical health pandemic, but also a mental health pandemic. And that notion of relationships was critically important. The outlets that student activities and athletics played was for us fundamental. And so we went on trips in consultation with our medical doctor, and I would like to express appreciation to Dr. Van Amerengen, Zichrono Livracha, who passed away, but appreciated that dialectic, that importance of being able to have both of those simultaneously. So we went on trips to Topgolf, we went on trips paintballing, and we really stressed the importance of this socialization. And the process, which to me was really, really important, was there was collaboration and there was conversation. It wasn't a decision that was made in ivory tower. It wasn't a decision that was just made with a medical professional. It was done in consultation with all of the various stakeholders, and it was communicated, again, with values, not just we're going to do this, but with an explanation of what we're going to do. And I found that we really were able to peel back, I think, the many fabrics that make up, or the many threads that make up a fabric, to understand how all of these pieces have to go together for the sense of a community. And just to speak to the last point that you raised, it is a process very much that we still use. I'll give again just very quick examples. Number one is
just one example.
Okay. I've done this at faculty meetings at the beginning of the year, where we sit and we really talk through our values and how the upcoming year is going to be a balance of those values and why we're going to do everything we do within the calendar. It allows for a healthy conversation to take place. Sometimes there are things we didn't think about and balances that we can strike and tweaks that we can make based on understanding our values in action, and understanding that sense of collaboration, that it all goes together, all those threads into one cohesive fabric.
Interesting. So Rabbi Karapkin, moving from the school again to the pulpit, like the most obvious conflict from a pulpit perspective was Bikur Cholim versus the concern of infection. And how do you get past that conflict? Did you see specific areas of conflict or ideals clashing? Any examples that you could share with us?
Yeah, I mean, there was conflict almost every day at the beginning of the pandemic. I mean, the very first conflict is, how do we, as a Beit HaKnesset, a place which is supposed to be open 365 days of the year to provide spiritual aid and access to Torah study and prayer, how are we supposed to close the doors? And if we are supposed to close the doors, is it going to be absolute closure? Or is it going to be limited closure? I mean, that was the cognitive dissonance that our entire community felt was really quite palpable. I mean, and there's another issue here that I think needs to be fleshed out a little bit more. I touched a little bit upon it in my essay, but the differing attitudes within the Orthodox community towards how to deal with the pandemic, whether to be completely closed, lock, stock, and barrel, or whether to be partially open, how much it was important to abide by governmental requirements, and how much it was okay to bend the rules or try to go behind the back of government officials in order to be able to keep our schools and shuls open. This is something that I think we're so law and order in our community and wanted to abide by whatever the government told us. Now, in retrospect, the government has gotten so many things wrong about COVID, whether it was the masking or the vaccine or so many other things, that perhaps we have to change our entire orientation within our religious community as far as where we go moving forward. And I think that's created a lot of instability in the way that we think as a society, and specifically the way we think as a religious community as well.
So Rabbi Rothberg, as a member of the RCBC and one of the first rabbinic councils to really shut down tight, Bergen County was shut down pretty tight. Have you witnessed that same post-COVID tension where people had all this faith in the rules and then saw the rules didn't work exactly or were not, that faith was not rewarded? And have you changed your messaging, or have there been specific interactions within the community, within the shul, that you've seen because of that tension?
My impression, and I was not the president of the RCBC at the time, but certainly it was a very cohesive, coordinated effort. And I think for the most part, we were all coming from the same place. My impression is that the members of our community were and remain, you know, particularly proud about the way the leadership handled things in real time. You know, we were all at the time working with all the information that we had. And you know, when I listen to Rabbi Karabkin, I think to myself, gee, you know, I agree with everything you're saying, but, you know, if we had to do it all over again, how could we do it differently? I mean, what does that mean for us? Because it hurts even to, you know, to say these words. But I'm not questioning the lack of trust that exists and the questions that have yet to be answered. Absolutely, you know, we are left with many, many questions. But what if the next crisis that comes along, we find ourselves in a similar position? Are we now going forward? Are we going to say now, at this point on, everybody does what they think is right? We're no longer going to trust institutions. We're no longer going to trust quote science, doctors, government, whatever the case may be. I don't know that we can, and that doesn't necessarily mean that in retrospect we're right about every decision we made. So I haven't personally received feedback that says, you know, what were you guys thinking? You know, this was just, you know, terrible leadership on your part. There was a lot of criticism, and maybe in retrospect, you know, it was well deserved, that it took us a very, very long time to communicate, you know, how, you know, what the off ramp looks like. I think if, you know, if we were, you know, exceptionally well prepared without even realizing it, to go ahead and to make some very, very important critical decisions, you know, at the first and earliest points in time, perhaps we were equally maybe, you know, negligent in not really being able to figure out, you know, how in a coordinated, cohesive, manageable way as a community, we can now begin to slowly but surely get back to where we were beforehand. And maybe to a certain extent, we're still sort of paying the price for that because, you know, things were very disjointed initially, and maybe to a certain extent, you know, they still are. You know, a lot of the splintering that exists in not just in this community, but overall, the fact that so many things look different than they were beforehand is because there was not a hard reset. We didn't, you know, we didn't quote unquote open up in the same way that we closed down. You know, there was a very clear shutdown, and things don't look the same that they once did. I mean, even my shul is an example. The lineup of minyanim on Shabbos morning, they have a whole new, there's a whole new format to Shabbos morning in my shul. You like it, you don't like it, better, worse. That could never have happened were it not for, you know, a complete and total shutdown. But the way things evolved was much more organic. It was much more situational in the moment. And now, several years later, many of us are scratching our heads. Does this make any sense? But it's very, very difficult to go at this point to go ahead and put the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah. So Rabbi Matanki, so you wear multiple hats. So I'll give you, you know, a minute and a half, 2 minutes to either choose to respond in the school to conflicts or to either of the points that were just made regarding communal or shul, or from a shul perspective in terms of conflicts. How do you see this evolving?
Well, I agree with everything that has been said, and just want to add a couple of notes. One thing that I found important during, as a head of school during COVID, was actually trying to create some sense of routine among the students. That it was, that part of what we tried to do was recreate, when we were online, a school day. When we came back in, a program that was manageable. We created new programs, called them pop-ups, which were just once a month. We took time off of class and just had something fun outside where we could do it by grade level so that they could have some fun, be able to get release some of the tension they had. But the routine was something that was very, very important to us in trying to look at it. In terms of reevaluating, Rabbi Kahn is one of the great educators in our generation and in America today. I will disagree with one piece, and that is, if we didn't do that all the time before COVID, thank God we're doing it after COVID. But I just feel we always have to be changing and looking, and the routine has always been something that I've tried to get away from, to try to shake it up, even though we need the routine for students to feel comfortable. In terms of what happened in the shuls, I noted also, just as an aside in my essay, one other piece which also has occurred, and that is there are people who have disappeared. In my community, it seems to be a larger number of people who have disappeared are the women, where women's attendance at shul seems to have shrunk. I don't know if it occurred anywhere else beyond Chicago, but younger families, especially women, were coming in much greater numbers before, and I think part of it is because of what occurred during COVID, the sense of being at home, and that opportunity. There is no question in my mind that there has been some stabilization. Chicago and Toronto share in a great thing together. It's called winter. And so the outdoor minyanim had to stop at some point. They couldn't continue. But there are communities where the weather never turns really bad. And there are still backyard minyanim taking place because people were looking for other forms or looking for the informality and the speed. Davening is shorter in shuls today. And it was one of the things we had to deal with. How do you, you know, initially, how do we cut down davening to be able to be within the guidelines? Then how do we expand it? And then how do we explain to Balabatim? We were able to do all of that in such a short amount of time. Well, now we need a lot more time to do it again because we're going back. So we didn't go back. We get out of shul 15, 20 minutes earlier on Shabbos than we used to. And it's just from not singing Aleinu and a couple of other things along the way.
So, Rabbi Karapkin, in your essay, I must say, kind of, you waxed poetically, paraphrasing the Kli Yakar, that COVID acted like sunlight, revealing different aspects of the community, much like it bleaches fabric or darkens skins. What do you think was an example of perhaps the most surprising or overlooked truth about our community that all of a sudden became apparent during COVID? That, you know, as soon as we saw it, it was like that had always been there, but it took COVID to bring that out.
So there are a few things using that analogy that you used in the essay. Some people view their shul attendance as a social event. And when the socialization option or opportunity was restricted because of COVID, these people just stopped coming to shul entirely, because their goal was more of the social benefits than it was for the spiritual benefits. That's sort of a downside that we noticed. Some people felt either trapped or mismatched in their previous shul community. And that's why when things completely shut down and then reopened, there was like a game of musical chairs. And that was also something that sort of was brought to light. I also think that the focus on self-care that was a result of COVID has spilled over to the way that we view community. During COVID, it was you could say, in a sense, it was every man for himself, every woman for herself, because we all were in a panic mode, just trying to get by with our groceries and our toilet paper and things like that. And I think that definitely has had an effect, a long-term effect, on how we view how much we choose to contribute, not monetarily, but how we choose to view ourselves as part of the collective versus as the individual. But from a positive standpoint, I think as Rabbi Rothwack said, it has allowed shuls to rebrand and reposition themselves. And our Shabbos morning lineup is also quite different from what it was. And that was a refreshing opportunity to sort of out with the old and in with the new.
Rothwack, building on that theme, to put you on the spot, one thing in your shul, whether it's Pesach, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, one thing during the course of the year that is the most different, and you're happy that it's different, outside of the topic of your essay, which we'll get to in just a moment. Just one thing over the course of the year, davening, chesed, shiurim, shalashedis, you name it, just one thing that became obvious that needed to change.
Yes, I'm going to give an example that seems so local and so insignificant, but what I like about it is, first of all, it's for me, it's the truthful answer to this question, and I think it's not necessarily the typical answer that you would hear from us. At least the moment speaks to me most is one that really only happens once a year, But first of all, this change in of itself is rather significant. And I think what it reveals to me is that we can really, really think creatively about virtually everything that we do. And just because we've always done things a certain way doesn't mean we must continue. But Hiros Chametz in my shul, and I'm sure like many shuls prior to COVID, consisted of set times in which people can come to see me in my office. And invariably there would be long lines of people that would be, you know, trying to essentially, you know, complete a 2-second transaction, but sometimes they'd be waiting online for 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes, sometimes very frustrated, especially because some of those individuals wanted more than just, you know, 10 seconds. In 2021, when we were trying to just come up with a more streamlined and still thinking about safety, particularly for those who were concerned at that particular point in time. So somebody introduced me to Calendly, which is just a very, you know, simple app, which allows people to sign up. And I created essentially 5-minute slots for people to sign up. And in the years that since I've continued this, and everybody appreciates it very much, it is true that it is a much greater time commitment for me, because now I'm opening up, you know, hundreds of slots, 5 minutes each. But at the same time, we've completely relieved all of ourselves of that pressure. Individuals come in and feel that they have, and I feel that I have the opportunity to spend 5 minutes, which may seem like, you know, an insignificant amount of time, but in many instances, it's a gateway. It's an opportunity to just go ahead and check in to see what's going on, to see what's coming up, deciding when, with whom to follow up after Yom Tov. And it's just really, really, really a great way to connect. Does this have anything directly to do with COVID? No, it would never have happened otherwise, because I wouldn't even stop to consider making a change. But that's sort of the point that I'm making. And that is that the great disruption of COVID forced us to do things a little differently. And now there's no going back. And I know that I'm here to talk only about shuls, not schools, but to me, this is very, very similar, at least in my opinion, as a parent, as a consumer of the experience of parent-teacher conferences. It's amazing. It's so refreshing and relaxing and just so much more meaningful now that, I don't know if every school does it this way, but at least the schools that I've been attending parent-teacher conferences, you know, doing it virtually with set times, it's just a whole new experience, a very positive experience, something used to be very frustrating beforehand.
So that's actually a great segue, because you're mentioning and you're discussing the requirement for a fundamental shift to take place in order for new constructs to be created. You wrote very movingly about the gravitational pull of societal norms, even in the face of crisis and clarity, and specifically focusing on the fact that we had a moment in time where we had the COVID simchas, which were simple but meaningful and deep, and how unfortunately that seems to have gone away. And I guess the question is to you is, aside for unique individuals, Yechidei Skula, who have tremendous internal resolve, do you think it's possible for meaningful change to take place at the communal level, whether it's COVID simchas, whether it's people making aliyah, whether it's spiritual growth? Do you need the introduction of some type of seismic external factor, the 6-day war, COVID, Kriyas Yamsuf? Is it possible for there to be a ground up movement from individuals to actually cause significant change? Or do we need this wake up call, which perhaps doesn't even always work completely? How do you respond to that?
I personally believe that it is possible. And, you know, my decision to write on this topic was not merely, you know, taking advantage of an opportunity to vent and to lament as I do, quite honestly, because to me it was and it remains very disappointing that so much of what we were able to experience. And again, I'm not going to reflect on my article right now, but I think the key part over there was the fact that everyone who was experiencing it, for the most part, found these new simchas that had to be modified, found them to be truly inspiring and beautiful and emotional, enjoyed them, and would say things like, why didn't we always do things this way? And this is so wonderful. And this is the nicest wedding of our mitzvah I've ever attended. But yet, you know, we're back to where we started. I chose to write about this because I really, really do believe that it is possible, but I don't think it's possible unless there's a really, really, comprehensive effort that would have to, require, many, many different parties and constituents. And, and then this is an example where it's not necessarily bottom up or top down, but probably, a lot of both. This is not an issue where rabbis could really lead on exclusively, because it has to be, individuals who are inspired to go ahead and to make changes of this sort can do so. We've seen other areas. There are definitely other areas over the course of the last generation. We've seen some very, very positive changes in our community, segments in our community who previously were not involved, were not engaged, did not have access to programming, to Talmud Torah, and so many things have changed because of the fact that people have said, we want something different. Whether it's Lama Nigora, why should we be, losing out on something that's really meaningful? Or as a community, there's so much more that we can do. If you think about the social programming that exists for, whether it's for individuals who, women, divorced women, there's an organization, I Shine for siblings, for, all of these programs that exist are all, they were all started by individuals who saw an opportunity in need, and now they've become sort of embedded within the structures of our community, and we can't imagine, how we existed beforehand without them. Such a wonderful feature of our community. So I do see this as well, but although this is going to take, I imagine, a lot more time and effort, and it would have to be, very carefully thought out and orchestrated in order for it to be successful.
So you're a fan of the Nachshon Ben Aminadav approach. You need one person to jump in and then change can be made. Rabbi Matanki, how do we educate our children to become those individuals who are willing to make fundamental changes, swim against the current, sticking with the Yam Suf motif, but really kind of just being willing to jump in first? How do we do that in school? How do we do that in shul?
Well, if you want to take the full mushel, first we have to teach them how to float and how to swim, which I think goes back to our original concept of resilience, of being able to give them those tools. Give them opportunities when they're in school to take leadership roles. Once upon a time, there were simple structures of student councils and things like that. I'm not sure how successful they are. I think what's more successful are all of the various clubs and teams where we ask students to take real leadership roles, even in classes where it used to be, the teacher lectured and the students were sitting on the side. Now you find some of the very same tools that were brought into, they were from graduate school, being brought into high school, where students are presenting. It's much more common for students to be presenting their work and taking a role in front of others. So if you want them to jump in, teach them how to swim. So when they jump in, they're not going to drown. They'll be able to succeed.
Khan, you don't have to stick with the swimming motif, but I'll ask a similar question. Do you believe? I'm sorry.
I said he gets it easy. Okay.
do you believe that can be taught, and do you believe that your alumni, in whatever capacity, or that adults can make the same changes that kids, that youth make? Is there hope for our community to make the changes that are necessary?
Yes, I very much agree with Rai Rothwax's sentiments, both lamenting the missed opportunities, but also the optimism towards the future. And I think we can, and quite honestly, I think we will make changes. Some are driven by necessity. The two that come to mind first are post-October 7th. I'll walk to pre-October 7th. Rabbi Daniel Alter, the head of school at Moriah, was actually trying to organize a groundswell of support among schools where we would all understand the need to advocate at the UN. Going back to the days we grew up with, different, whether it's Soviet Union, Jewry, but different things that we had strong advocacy needs for, and lamenting, or I guess in a positive way, we didn't have that need, but lamenting the lack for our students in that, understanding what it means to drive change and to advocate, and to really take those leadership roles. So prior to October 7th, he actually wanted to create a rotation of schools that would go and to start to talk about anti-Semitism and Iran protesting outside of the UN. But the reality is, we plan, God plans better, post October 7th, our students have taken strong leadership roles to understand that we need to really drive change, and we model it for them. So we did take a strong stance as far as college campuses were concerned, and that's something that our students see, and they understand that groundswell of support. We have that right now with government funding and schools also, realizing that that's the what will change the tuition structure if we can get government funding for schools. And there's an understanding and appreciation that even our high school students are getting involved in, that we need to develop those advocacy skills. So we need to teach them, we need to model it for them, and we need to set them up for the ability to do that. I referenced before, I'll just repeat it now, is the smartphone revolution. Not that our students are leading a smartphone revolution, but they are going to see, you know, what it looks like to try to initiate change. That's been a tremendous change that's taking place. I think one of the biggest social changes that will take place in the generation that our kids are in right now is understanding what it means to actually disconnect from smartphones. So they're getting that experience with what change looks like, how we drive grassroots efforts towards change, and how we work through what I think Ray Rothwack said also, which is the need to coalesce, the need to build a sense of community and camaraderie around change, because it's not something that can just be driven by one person. It's something that needs to be done with a broad constituency, a broad community.
Excellent. All right, Karapkin, we're going to give you the last word to take us home. And I guess to frame the question slightly more sharply, your community is a huge community with many different components. Within your essay, you referenced that. Do you see different elements of your community more inclined to be the change, to be the point of the spear? Or it really is about individuals who take that lead, and it doesn't matter where, what area of the community they're coming from, which demographic, female, male, adult, teen, kid, is it about the personality of the individuals, or is there something about the community that they come from or the demographic that they come from?
Yeah, I think that people who are craving community will be the ones who are the greatest innovators of what the next chapter, the next iteration of Jewish community will look like. And I see that most with young adults, whether they're in high school or university level. They are clamoring back to shul in some way or another, because socialization for them is really so important. I've also noticed a revolution. Let's just recall, I mean, even though it is so ubiquitous now, let's just remember Zoom didn't exist for most of the world 5 years ago. And what that has meant for Talmud Torah has been revolutionary. The fact is, yes, it's true, our live Daf Yomi Shir tapered has diminished from the way it was before COVID. But the number of people who are studying Daf Yomi today in our community, and I suspect in other communities as well, has mushroomed because of the accessibility of Torah study all over the world today, whether it's live, whether it's recorded. And I think that's something we should be very, very excited about, very, very proud of, that we're dealing now with more educated and more committed balabatim, at least a very significant segment of them, who previously had nothing to do with Talmud Torah during the week, are really now getting serious. And that to me is a very, very positive development, something that we can be very optimistic about for the future.
Happy to end on an optimistic note. Thank you, each and every one of you, for your time and for your powerful insights.